take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your whalebone balustrade of music, news, and cultural estrangement. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. At last, the view is fierce. All that matters is a who is open chest. You're hearing Stone Milker from Bjork's new record, Volnicura. John Pareles.
Hey, Ben.
You traveled to Reykjavik not too long ago to interview Bjork in her house to talk about this record, which was more or less finished at the time.
Well, actually, it was still unfinished. They were still mixing parts of it. Some of the things have changed since she played it for me.
And
this was back in November, so.
In November, right. And you were planning to write a piece that would come out a little bit later than now, but some circumstances changed.
The album was leaked, and Bjork's, quote, impulsive response was to put out the digital version immediately.
Now, you spoke to her in November, but you also spoke to her since then, since the leak and the official release. Can you talk about her decision to release it? Why did it feel right?
Well, for her, she just wanted to get it out. I mean, this is a cathartic, emotional album. It's directly about her breakup with Matthew Barney after 13 years. They have a daughter together. These kind of things are wrenching. And the songs.
And she was explicit about that.
Yeah, she was explicit about that. And the songs are about that. And I think she just wants to be done with it. You know, it's out there. It's in the past. It's a finished piece of artwork.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she said that artists, musicians are always impatient to get their stuff out. But there was this very carefully planned rollout where there were Carnegie Hall concerts to start the tour, and there's a Museum of Modern Art exhibition. They're both in March when they were supposed to release the album. So she did get kind of ambushed. She ambushed back. But she, when I spoke to her, she was saying she felt relieved to have it finally out.
Do you think that it's truly done?
Oh, yeah, I do think it's truly done.
You do?
Yeah. I know because I talked to Arca, her co-producer, mm-hmm. and he was going to remix late in November.
I asked that because of the Madonna situation.
Yeah. I really think this is pretty much a finished album. I think they finished mixing it November, December. It was done. That was the plan.
Before we wrestle with the implications of Bjork making a personal album, Bjork the Universalist.
Bjork the Scientist,
too. And the Scientist. Can you please describe Bjork's house?
Well, yeah, it's not huge. It's a house by the ocean. She looks out on one of these startling, stark, black sand Icelandic beaches. It's a cozy house. I mean, she's got books spilling off her shelves. It's, you know, it's got furniture and things like that. And it's got all these strange nature touches in it.
Mm-hmm.
The chandelier in her living room is this sphere, maybe not the size of a disco ball and not the size of a bowling ball, but somewhere in between, and it's entirely white feathers. The staircase, the rail on the staircase, is held up by a whalebone skeleton. Not endangered, mink whales, they're fine. Little things like that. I mean, there's a floor of sand. She just has nature inside her house. I mean, she's always spoken about how much Iceland's elemental landscape affects her, how much it's in her music. So it's also in her house. The walls of the house were painted lilac because the two colors of this album are neon yellow, which is the color of emergency, and lilac, which is, to her, the color of soothing. So the house is a changing exhibition, apparently.
Mm.
She's got a wonderful view. I mean, you sit where her laptop is in her second-floor studio. She's got you know, some DVDs and stuff on the shelves, I noticed Fanny and Alexander, which is Ingmar Bergman, which she's talked about in relationship to the kind of claustrophobic feeling of this album. She also had an Aretha Franklin record up there. And she has the ranges for string instruments, the notes a cello can play, so that when she's arranging them on a computer, she's actually making arrangements that the instruments can play.
Oh, I see.
But she looks out over an ocean, a mountain, and a whole lot of sky.
And as you described in your piece, she writes a lot of her songs when she's out walking. She said something to the effect of that's why there's always a certain beats per minute range.
Yeah, 85 to 90 beats per minute, which is walking speed. But she apparently has always done this. I mean, one reason, the song we heard, Stone Milker, is going to be the virtual reality video at the Museum of Modern Art. I almost saw her making the video because I couldn't see her actually making the video because they had a 360-degree virtual reality camera, so everyone had to get out of the shot. Mm. I saw the process of her making the video, but she made the video because she wrote the song while walking on that beach.
So in any case, you got a sense of the landscape that she's walking through as she's making Bjork music.
Yeah, very much so.
Everybody knows where she lives, I'm guessing. Reykjavik is not that big, right? Well, I mean, not that populous.
I told the taxi driver the address, and he said, oh, Bjork's house. So I think so. She's not paparazzi'd. I think they give her respect.
Right.
Because we went clubbing, too. And, you know, a couple of people wanted selfies, but a couple in 4 hours is not that much.
Well, I want to ask you more about that in a second. But this opens up a question of public versus private. And in the past, Bjork has been, well, somewhat famous for being a little bit guarded, but basically just a smart interview who doesn't want to put up with stupid questions and also doesn't want stupid intrusions of media into her life.
Which is smart.
Which is smart, yeah. But also, she's the kind of artist that would seem to prefer that because her songs go very quickly into metaphors about, you know, universal things. And as you pointed out, science.
Mm-hmm. Well, she likes to zoom out.
Right.
I mean,
as almost as far as possible.
Yeah, to like tectonic plates and stars being born.
She's not a kitchen sink artist, but this record has a little bit of kitchen sink in it.
Not so much kitchen sink, but definitely Broken Heart. I mean, there aren't a lot of details. There are a lot of feelings on this album. I mean, there aren't a lot of concrete, you did this, I did this. It's more refracting the mental landscape.
And I guess the small bit of you did this that is in the album, well, it's been seized on and quoted. The specific lines that refer to her relationship, a violation of trust.
But this isn't a revenge album, though. I mean, this isn't a teenage breakup. This is an adult breakup.
Yeah.
This is a breakup involving a child. This is a breakup of people who have been together for 13 years. This is not, you broke up, I'm writing a song about you, Taylor Swift.
Right.
Or it's not Adele rolling in the deep, you know, you could have had it all, you know, you blew it.
Right.
It's more Bjork looking inward and reflecting on how much it hurt and how to get past it.
All I'm saying is that the response one might expect from Bjork would be songs about, you know, planetary motion or something, you know, that would be an indirect metaphor about a breakup. Whereas she decides to actually go in there.
Yeah, it's brave. I do think she works on intuition. This is the stuff that was coming out of her. I mean, she said to me, I hated myself, how typical it was. I hated how cliched I felt, but at the same time, the songs came pouring out. That's not a direct quote, but
you mean how cliched it was to
how cliched
to make
her
a
feelings
personal,
were.
Ah, how, okay. How cliched her feelings were when she sort of listened to them in her own mind.
Yeah, and putting them on the page. She also told me that usually she sketches out lyrics probably while she's walking, and then, you know, fixes them up, thinks about them, edits them. Here she kept her original impulses because the important thing about it, the thing that her artistry seized on was how immediate they were, how close they were. She didn't put a cerebral superstructure on it. She just let it out.
So let's start with Stone Milker, which we just heard. How did she make these songs?
The album has a very fixed palette, as many of her albums have. It's string orchestra. It's electronics and it's voices. Mm-hmm. Her voice mostly. Anthony Hegarty is on one song.
And the strings make you think of Homogenic.
Homogenic is much more about the beat, and the strings are Hollywood. The strings are the strings are much more of a retro feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And Homogenic is the songs are more, you know, stomping along.
But it's funny how that record from, what, 97?
Yes.
Which also, I think, was apparently after a breakup or a series of them. In The Listener, I think it elicits some of the same emotional reactions.
I do think they're cousins. They're definitely cousins. Also, I mean, she sings Joga, the great Bjork phrase that everyone will always remember her by. You know, when she sings the word emotion in Joga, it echoes mm-hmm. on this album, where she's also talking about, I have emotional needs in this song.
Right.
There's definitely a parallel there. This is a lot more unearthly, though, unearthly than Homogenic. This is more out there because the electronics aren't really for dancing or for rocking out. They're more of a kind of nervous pressure in the brain.
Mm-hmm. So on this record, she's working with, among others, Arca
mm-hmm.
and the Hacks and Cloak.
Right.
And can we also talk about Jessica Hopper's interview for a minute?
Sure.
In that interview, which came out in Pitchfork last week, Bjork is very explicit talking about how, yes, I worked with these people, but I want to get this on the record. You know, I do this stuff. They work with me.
Right. The perception is that she's the plaything of the producer.
Exactly.
And she told me some of this, too. This was on her mind, clearly. She said, you know, I do 80 or 90% of albums myself, but I find myself talking about the collaborations because they're social.
Right. The collaborations are very important to her. She doesn't want to do these things alone.
Right.
At the same time, she – and I think it sounded as if she had even talked about this with
yeah.
Arca, specifically saying to him, look, this is something I want to talk about when the record comes out,
mm-hmm.
you know, that it's not just I'm the singer and I vaguely write the songs. No, she's really in control and she's collaborating with somebody else.
But you can also hear that through all of her work. If you look back now, I mean, she's always the auteur. She's not in somebody else's movie. I'm glad she's clarifying it now. It was interesting talking to Arca because he said he would be happy to be just the guy who executes. I mean, what Bjork said was that it took her 3 years to make Vespertine because she did so much of it herself and she's slow. I think she is a studio rat, but she's not a fast studio rat like some other people.
So working with other people among other things.
It just like
things,
gets stuff done.
It gets stuff done.
Maybe I could fix that faucet, but it would probably be a lot quicker to get a plumber.
She's working with somebody else who has another schedule, and so she can
yeah.
speed
well, also,
up.
Also, she can say, you know, I want to do this, and he knows which patch cords to plug in or whatever. But what Arca said was, you know, I would be happy. He said at one point, I felt like a ligament. Which is a great metaphor, you know, just that he's the one flexing the muscle with the orders from the brain. And he was happy to do that. He said that most of the songs were fully blueprinted by the time he got there and just needed to be done. One of them, Not Get, was a lot more collaborative.
Let's hear another track from the record. Shall we hear Quicksand?
Let's listen to Quicksand.
So that's Quicksand. A lot of the record is slow or spacious. Quicksand has a different feeling because it's got, sounds like, I don't know, maybe jungle beats.
Yeah, a little bit of breakbeat or something in there,
yeah.
drum and bass. She found this beat she heard and just fell in love with. It's by a guy named Spaces. Apparently, she put that on her computer and started playing with it and worked it into the song or wrote the song around it. I'm not sure. But it does jump a lot more. The funny thing about this album is the way you produce a singer is to have the background support her, usually. And in Quicksand and some of the other songs on the album, the background is fighting her.
Fighting her, yeah.
It's not even a counterpoint. It's like a second opinion. And this one, she's really grappling with them. I don't know. It's a strange feeling listening to the album to have this battle going on.
So it's argumentative dance music. But let me hear a little bit of your description of not Bjork arguing with the beat, but flowing with it at these clubs you went to.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, here was this Saturday in November. 10 o'clock in the morning, you get to the desolate lighthouse where she wrote some of the record, where there's this black, rocky, slippery beach because it's drizzling and it's Iceland and it's November. She's wearing this emergency-colored yellow dress. She's wearing white platform shoes, which do not make it easy to climb over a 10-foot seawall. She's standing on the rocks with this super high-tech virtual reality 360-degree camera, dancing around it. We can't have endless takes because the road to the island floods at high tide, which means you basically have a six-hour window when you can come and go to the lighthouse. Mm. So it's freezing out there. She's doing a million takes. They also do some more takes, a more standard camera on the beach. If it were me, I would, you know, I would go back to my warm house, light a fire, take the night off. Not Bjork. She has a wrap party for the crew at her house.
After the shoot on the seawall.
Yeah, this is the same day.
Yeah.
It's a couple of days after her birthday, and this friend of hers gives her a scarf with Michael Jackson on it that she adores, and it turns out she is a complete, unironic, un-anything Michael Jackson fan. Michael Jackson is it. She loves him. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the party's still going, and it's like, oh, why don't we go out? So we hit a cafe. We hit this weird little basement club, maybe holds about 100 people when it's full and had like six in it. She takes over for the DJ and starts playing Bollywood songs and Chaka Khan songs.
From her iPod?
From her iPod. Mm-hmm. And dancing up a storm. I mean, she would like cue up a song and then she and some girlfriends would head over to the pool table and climb on it and dance.
But still then, in the platform shoes?
She was probably wearing some kind of tall shoes, but I don't think it was the same white platform.
Didn't she rip up the felt on the table?
She was more rolling on the table than stomping on the table.
But so, if anyone is allowed to rip up the felt on a pool table in a
Bjork.
Bar in Reykjavik, yeah, it's Bjork.
She has exquisite timing because we go to the hip-hop club down the street. It's sort of half empty. 20 minutes later, it is packed. 20 minutes later, there's a line down the block. So she knows what time this club has its moment when you can get in the door. It's just like dancing frenzy for the next 3 hours.
Was she DJing there as well?
No, she was not DJing. This was a hip-hop DJ playing hits, mm-hmm. of which she knew them all. I mean, if you think Bjork is this, you know, abstruse art woman, believe me, she knows her Beyoncé songs.
Again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think you expect because there's this whole academic cottage industry of Bjork studies out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can read the Museum of Modern Art catalog. I mean, you know, people are thinking really hard about Bjork, but at the same time, she dances. She has fun. She loves pop. I was actually thinking that one window into her music is the combination of pop and avant-gardeness of really great R&B, of those Chaka Khan songs where Chaka mm-hmm. Khan's voice is filtered and all these weird effects are on it, but there's and the rhythm is this fractured, staggered, wonderful funk thing.
You mean like I Feel For You?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's a soulful voice in the middle of it. That's one thing she's going for, even with, you know, the harps and the xylophones and the string orchestras.
That would make sense. Well, that's her time.
Yeah.
I Feel For You is 1984. She would have been what? 20,
well, her solo career starts in 92, but she was already, like, in music. So, sure.
So, let's talk a little bit about the MoMA show. You and I have seen large idea Bjork presentations before, mm-hmm. like the thing in the science museums, which the Biophilia Tour, right, which was kind of an incredible piece of execution, among other things, and very complicated tools and machines and stuff that you – beyond your wildest imaginings.
Well, also nerddom beyond your wildest imaginings. I mean, one of those biophilia instruments was, you know, a giant Tesla coil that played bass notes.
Yeah.
Very abstruse ways to get what you could probably do with a synthesizer patch.
So what's your understanding of the MoMA show? What's going to be involved?
I talked to the curator, Klaus Biesenbach, at MoMA, and they showed me the mock-up. I'm in the lobby of MoMA, which is open to the public before you buy your tickets, which is nice. They will have the biophilia instruments, and they'll have videos of them playing. One interesting thing about MoMA is that they bought the biophilia apps, which means that as operating systems change, they're going to keep them alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it won't just be the iOS operating system. They're going to keep programming them, you know, as long as they can keep them, like, as part of the museum collection. So they have eternal life now. But the biophilia instruments will be in the lobby. You can see them. You can hear them. They're pretty wacky. You should go see them. And then upstairs is a labyrinth through Bjork's solo career. I mean, they'll have the videos. They'll have the costumes. Each room is a different album. Bjork had herself 3D scanned, and then they 3D printed Bjork's to wear her costumes. It's a headphone experience. It's only 100 people at a time. The headphones have location-based triggering. So depending on where you are in the room, you will hear the song differently. They've taken the stems of the music, the digital pieces of the music, and they're apparently making them remix themselves as you walk through the room.
That's interesting. So each song becomes an environment.
Yeah. She was very leery of doing an exhibition because she pointed out she's not a visual artist. I mean, the costumes and things are the least I'm sure they're very hands-on, but they're always a designer, Alexander McQueen, whoever. The costumes are made by someone else. She didn't want it to be an exhibition of her costumes. You know, she wanted her music to be front and center. And so you walk into these rooms and you're back in the album, you know, looking at whatever persona or image Bjork was thinking about back then and being inside the music. I hope they can pull this off because it sounds really wonderful.
Which I guess kind of mirrors her. I mean, you were talking about the way she works on records before other people get involved.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of solitary time. And I can imagine with the atmospheric music that she makes, there's a feeling of total immersion.
Mm-hmm.
So this is maybe a visual or physical representation of Bjork as auteur.
Yeah, no, you're inside her head. The other thing she and the curator were both thinking about were song lines, which are ways of walking through the landscape mapped by songs and images. And so I think that this is the song line through Bjork's career. I mean, mm-hmm. I really hope they can pull it off. I'm so looking forward to it. At the moment, it's a little cardboard model on a desk. So they've got a month to turn it into architecture.
And this opens on
March 8th,
which is around the time the tour begins as well.
Yeah, I mean, this was it was a very elaborate plan. The other thing I wanted to talk about with this album, though, is, you know, besides the raw pain, she's still a scientist. I mean, in the opening song, she sings, "This is a moment of clarity. I should document it."
Clarity.
Yes. And if you're writing string arrangements, you know, you're sitting there with probably a computer, you know, thinking about chords, thinking about pacing. It's not a three-chord punk song that's hurled at you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really thought through. And the string arrangements especially are, they take their time. They worry about texture. They're very physical. The other thing about the MoMA exhibit, there's a room with Black Lake, which is the longest song on the album, 10 minutes long, very eerie, the saddest song on the album. When she played it for me, she said, "Don't worry, this is the saddest song. It gets happier from here."
Mm-hmm.
What she did when she recorded the song, which is about this really primal pain, she recorded the song with each of the 30 string instruments with a separate mic. When you walk into that room at MoMA, the speakers are such that each instrument comes out of a different speaker. So you are really inside the song. You can stand next to the second viola player if you want.
Mm-hmm.
You will be able to hear each instrument in its own space.
It sounds like Janet Cardiff's sound installations, like the one she did with the Thomas Tallis piece, where you've got 40 speakers arranged around a room, and each speaker is one voice in the choir.
Bjork told me she saw that, so I'm sure that's was on her mind.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's going to be the same physical arrangement of speakers or if they're going to be in the walls or the ceilings. Let MoMA work it out.
So what's interesting, just to circle back to one idea that you brought up, is that this is a heartbreak album, but of a different kind for pop music, or one that we don't see quite as often. In pop music, from heartbreak, you go straight to revenge. There's even lyrics in the record to this effect, something about maturity.
Right. She's saying, you know, oh, these emotions are complex. That's a sign of maturity.
Exactly. These emotions are complex. That's a sign of maturity. And I thought, wow, you know, like, are you even allowed to write lyrics like that as a pop singer? You know, because it sounds chiding. It sounds slightly condescending.
Well, she's actually chiding herself,
whatever,
though.
But it's a grown-up reaction, you know, especially when you get to a certain age, when you can hold positive and negative thoughts in your mind at the same time.
It's also her analytical sense. It's like, oh, right, I wish I could be as simple, but it's too complex. She's very self-conscious. I mean, it's not simple teenage pop. She maps outward. You know, she maps from the individual atom out to whatever level of the universe she can figure out. And that's what she's done all through her career.
In Black Lake, there's this moment two-thirds of the way through where a chord is held for a very long time. Did she talk to you about that and the construction of that song?
She did. I mean, it's very deliberate because the chord is held. There are vocal verses, really the most pained lyrics on the album. There are these vocal verses, and then there are these string chords that are held out longer deliberately than the verses. And she was writing, she said, at a time when she felt paralyzed with pain, and she could get a little bit out, and then she would be paralyzed again. She said each verse of this song is a week. And, you know, there's 10 or 15 words in the verse, maybe less. So these string freezes are very much, they're cerebral, but they're also, they go straight to the psychology. And it's a beautiful combination. We should listen to it.
Okay, well, let's go out with the ultimate downer of the record, but also like the great transcendent moment of the record, I think, too.
Yes.
Black Lake. And John Pareles, thanks for coming.
Thanks, Ben.
That's our show, and thank you for listening. You should read John Pareles' piece on Bjork, which is in this weekend's Arts and Leisure, at nytimes.com/music. There you will also find his review of Bjork's new record, Vulnicura. Our producers are Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez. Listen to our Spotify playlist, where we will have Bjork, and maybe we should put on some of the things, some of the songs that were on her iPod that she was jamming as a DJ.
And let's put some Arca on there too, because his record's wonderful.
And some Arca as well. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.